Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
American soccer fans, welcome to episode 126 of the USA Soccer Cast. We are bringing you everything about the U.S. national teams, the players, the leagues, and everything else that impacts the game of soccer in these United States. I'm Donald Wine. Today, we conclude our series of interviews with each of the candidates for U.S. Soccer Vice President. That election will take place at the Federation's annual general meeting that takes place in Dallas the weekend of February 8th. On this episode, we speak with Dr. Pete Zopfe, chairman of U.S. Youth Soccer and a member of the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors. He currently serves on the Sports Medicine Research, Education, and Advisory Committee and the Nominating and Governance Committee. He's also been a part of several other committees and task force while on the U.S. Soccer Board. As we have done with Nathan Goldberg and Mike Cullina, we're going to ask Dr. Zopfe questions on a number of topics facing U.S. soccer, including some that have extra importance for fans. I know you're looking forward to the conversation, so here it is, the interview with Dr. Pete Zopfe. We are here with Dr. Pete Zopfe, the chairman of U.S. Youth Soccer and a member of the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors. He is a candidate for U.S. Soccer Vice President. Pete, great to talk to you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Donald. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we have several questions in different categories we want to get to, but I want to start with the simple question. Why do you think you're the best choice for U.S. Soccer Vice President?
Well, that usually is the beginning question. You're right. So I've had the privilege of being on the U.S. Soccer Board now for 5.5 years. Had an opportunity to work with the current board and the current staff, which I think are extremely qualified for what they're doing. The last couple of years, we've had a lot of successes, achieved a lot of goals, and there's a number of initiatives right now, strategic initiatives that the staff and the board, including myself, are working on that I think are really going to make an impact for soccer in America over the next 3 to 4 years, which we know are critical with all of the events that are coming here.
So obviously there's a lot of things going on here. One thing that I know the board has been involved with over the last month or so is the moving of the headquarters from Chicago to just outside the Atlanta area. The new National Training Center is supposed to open up in the next couple of years. Everyone's going to be under one roof. What do you see as the biggest benefit to this new facility that you're going to have down there in Fayette County?
Yeah, I actually think it's a fantastic move on our part to do that. Obviously, it takes a lot of financial input, and we've been very fortunate to have some very generous donors. And obviously, the city of Atlanta and that area has been very gracious in helping us arrange this. So we're very excited of not only moving the headquarters down there, which will be obviously a benefit to our resources and the utilization of that, but also having a home for all of our national teams. And it includes the extended national teams. It excludes the DEI. I think it's going to be a really a mecca for soccer in America and something envious around the world. The other thing that I think is going to be an extreme advantage is we're going to be able to leverage the technology that's available in sports nowadays to improve our athletes' performance. A good example is the U.S. Performance Center up in North Carolina, up in Charlotte. And they actually are the home for the USA women's field hockey team, and they also are the home for US taekwondo and judo. And both of those sports have done extremely well in recent years because of the training and performance enhancement that they've received there. They're getting good nutrition, they're getting good mental health, emotional health, and physical health training, good monitoring in the area. And was able to tour that facility with Skip Gilbert, USYS CEO, and Todd Lockhart, the USYS current chair, who's be taking my place. We were able to tour that facility, and it was just fantastic. We've got to see some of the national team players doing their workouts and the monitoring, the specific one-on-one training. And I can just envision us having our national teams in one site, having that sort of intense performance-directed training, obviously enhancing our role and our performance in the future in World Cups, et cetera. So I think it's going to be a tremendous benefit for us. The one last thing I would add to that is a lot of people just envision it as being a site for the headquarters and for the national teams and extended national teams. It's actually going to be a focal point also for the entire membership of US Soccer because there's going to be workshops there, meetings there. It in turn will be kind of the magnet for the entire membership and entire US Soccer. And obviously, Atlanta is a very good place, good location for this to be at.
You mentioned rightfully that a lot of the focus has been on the facilities for the national teams, the extended national teams being a part of that, and also being eventually the new headquarters for the operations of U.S. Soccer. But one area that I know you're very familiar with, I know you're a level eight referee. A lot of people don't realize what it takes for someone to become certified as a coach or a referee, how many courses you have to go through, all the different travel programs and different avenues you can take. But what a lot of people realize now is that it is very expensive to get to a level where you're able to get a lot of coaches certified to be able to grow that contingent of US soccer. How do you help make that a little bit more affordable and help also help navigate the red tape so that people don't look at it as a daunting task to become a coach for their son's travel team?
Yeah, great question. And so you bring up a good point. Cost has become a barrier for all aspects of soccer, not just for players, but also for referees and for coaches. Because to get your licensing, especially to advance to a higher level, it takes a lot of time away from your occupation. It takes a lot of personal finances out of your pocketbook. And it can be hard to pay yourself back, so to speak. By getting the sort of exposure in games and experience. To become a referee or a coach, it takes more than going to a class. It takes refereeing games, it takes coaching players. And so those opportunities need to be provided. I think the National Training Center, just to bounce back to that, I think will provide an area and a location where some of that referee training and experience and also that coach training and experience can occur. But it's really going to require a concerted effort on the part of US Soccer, the various member organizations, the state associations, to really implement referee growth and coach growth throughout the United States. And an example would be with referees. I kind of break it into four categories. There's a recruitment phase, which is probably the easiest to grow numbers because you're recruiting new people that don't necessarily know, the biggest barrier being financial. But that can be approached by the various organizations and state associations underwriting the financial cost of that. An example is we just started a program in Cal North in conjunction with USYS, where we reached out to the University of California Davis women's soccer team. And I talked to, I met with the women's soccer coach and one of their assistant athletic directors about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And I asked them, what could we do to partner U.S. soccer and USYS with the collegiate system? And they were talking about coach training. And then we came up with the idea, well, what about referees? So I asked them, I said, do any of your ladies on your team referee? And the coach says, no, but I sure wish they knew the rules. And I said, well, what do you think about us trying to do a pilot program where we provide entry-level training for your players at no cost, and then provide them the opportunity to referee in some of the youth and adult games in Northern California? Well, they actually have March 3rd, that referee class planned. So that's a good example of how we can reach out and overcome those financial barriers for recruitment. The second part of refereeing is retention. And retention really involves number three and number four parts of refereeing, and that's referee abuse and promotion. So retention, you need to have those referees have a vision for what they can become. But in the meantime, you also don't need to have them abused on the field. And unfortunately, we see referee abuse at all levels. It seems like every day I look in the media and I see that there's some referee over in Europe or in one of the professional leagues being chased off the field by a fan. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the chanting from the stands anymore. It's the actual physical threat to those referees and the consequences of that. So I think referee abuse is one of those areas that we have to really address. And I think the good thing is the U.S. Soccer has started a referee abuse working group. It's actually headed by Mike Kalina as the chair of that group. He has a number of representatives from the membership that are part of that. That group has been populated and will start functioning over the next 2 weeks. We'll probably even have an update at the AGM in a week and a half. But that's one of the first working groups that's moving forward to address that issue. And last but not least, I would say promotion is the key to allow these referees to see there's something more than just going out and making some money on the weekend. Perfect example is the recent Women's World Cup final, where we had four American referees, three of them that were female, that were refereeing in the final. And that sort of kind of marketing and notoriety, I can't believe there's not a lot of young female referees in America that aren't aspiring to be the next Tory Pence in the World Cup. So I think those are the four areas with refereeing that I think are important to consider.
I want to get back to the safety part of things and the abuse in just a second. But before I do, just a follow-up to your question or to your answer, when we talk about some of the facilities that we have, right, obviously we're building the one outside Atlanta, but I know we currently have facilities. I think referees do their training in the Kansas City area. There's also been some training courses out in Southern California. Does U.S. Soccer, you know, in an effort to kind of keep that reach going, yeah, they may concentrate their efforts in Atlanta, but there's still plans to have some of these facilities across the nation so that people from all regions would be able to partake in some of these initiatives that you're talking about?
Yeah, great question. I had the opportunity when I went through my national goalkeeper licensing course to do that in Chula Vista down in Southern California. Fantastic facility. I would envision that U.S. Soccer is going to maintain these satellite facilities because, like you say, Kansas City, you know, we've got our facilities there, Hall of Fame there. We've got Chula Vista, which is a beautiful environment. And obviously, California is kind of a hotbed for soccer and the population that's down in that Southern California area. So I would envision us maintaining those satellite facilities and maybe even looking to expand to other areas of the country where you would have smaller satellite facilities, again, to keep that regional participation throughout the United States. And then still have, of course, the centralized facility down in Atlanta. We're such a big country, it's very hard to just centralize into one area We see that with USU soccer. We have our headquarters in Dallas and Frisco, which is in the Dallas area. So we're very centrally located, but we've got four different regions and it stretches from Hawaii up to Maine. And so we find that when we do our regional championships, we don't bring them all down to Texas. We go ahead and spread those throughout the regions. And I would imagine US soccer will continue that same sort of approach.
I mentioned, you know, you mentioned some of the abuse that referees receive and even coaches and stuff like that. I want to shift to the topic of safety, not just among referees and coaches, but also players. Of course, we've had the ACE report come out that chronicled a lot of, you know, harrowing tales coming from brave NWSL players who had come forward with their story about how certain, you know, certain stories that they brought or certain issues that they brought to US soccer or to other entities like Safe Sport were neglected or otherwise unattended to. I know the ACE implementation committee is out there and I've seen some of the work that that they're doing and they're that's a good start. But I think the question that I have is how do you rebuild the trust that was broken by places like Safe Sport in the eyes of these players so that when they do come forward to talk about abuse, talk about verbal abuse, referees, players, coaches, how do you rebuild that trust so that they feel comfortable in coming forward should something like that occur again in the future?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. One of the things I appreciated about Sally Yates' report and what her group did is it wasn't just focused on the professionals. I mean, obviously that was the initiating factors is the unfortunate occurrences and events that were happening with the NWSL and some of the young ladies involved with that. And we've heard about colleges, et cetera. But we've seen it in the youth landscape and in the grassroots landscape forever. And it's been a problem that we've addressed collectively as state associations and organizations. It's difficult, though. It's like fighting crime. You can never get rid of crime. You just always have to have an awareness of it and continue to try and address those issues when they come up and try to prevent it as best you can. And the best way to prevent is first a collaborative, collective effort for everybody to have that education and awareness. Being a physician, being a mandatory reporter, having done what I've done for 35 years, I've learned to read people and read situations, but it's taken experience, it's taken education along the way, and I can detect abuse some of the time, not all of the time, but I'm always aware and looking for it. That same sort of experience and education has to be widespread throughout our collective membership. If all of us are being aware and looking for abuse, whether it be coach player, whether it be referee, whether it be between players, we need to be able to look for that. I think Safe Sport made an effort, and I've been through all the classes. They're mandatory, but I had actually been through those kind of classes before. I think it does a good job on educating and raising awareness. Where it has a hard time, I think, functioning is the enforcement when something is discovered. Because there's a lot of incidents that come up, and the frustration that I know a lot of my membership feels is that there'll be reports turned in, and then there's either, quote unquote, not enough evidence, so that coach or that person is cleared, even though the state or other organization might have other means to discipline or monitor that coach. But because they've been cleared by Safe Sport and they have the sole authority over that, it creates a kind of a catch-22 for everyone. And so one of the reasons that we sent the letters to Congress 4 or 5 months ago, and they were co-authored by myself, Mike Kalina of US Club, Michael Karen of AYSO, and John Mata of the Adult Association, we sent that to Congress, but we also had our 54 state associations send letters to their representatives. Again, encourage them not necessarily to scrap the program, but to really take a good look at what the program was doing, the authority that was based, and to maybe make it more collaborative with the various organizations instead of having the sole authority to say yes or no to some of these reports. One of the outcomes that came from the Sally Yates report was U.S. Soccer developing their Safe Soccer program with Positive Coaching Alliance. And what that is a nice 30-minute module, again, putting education out there for any and every member to become more aware of the signs and symptoms that are associated with abuse and with some of the things that we're trying to correct and detect. So, that's a long answer to your question, but I think the short answer is essentially it's all of our responsibility, and it comes with education, experience, and I think collaboration between all of us.
Yeah, I think the main crux of my question was more, and you answered it, was more about the reporting portion of things, the fact that a lot of people felt they did their job, they took their report to the people that they were supposed to, and it was they turned a blind eye to it. And how do you rebuild that trust? Is it's a delicate question. It requires delicate answer, and it also requires just everyone, as you mentioned, being involved. You mentioned the fact that it's not just focused on professional players, it's also focused on the youth as well. The youth has had that issue. I want to switch to youth development, but a different aspect of youth development. Obviously, you are involved in youth soccer quite a bit. You're the chairman of US Soccer. This this program that we have, or I guess this map that we have, was reduced at one point to pay to play, but now it feels like a smorgasbord of different ideas on the table. We have some academies where there are free, but they're not accessible to a lot of people by distance or socioeconomic lines. How do you organize everything as vice president? How do you organize this system that is youth soccer and make it where it becomes one that can reach out to some of these neighborhoods that they're not reaching, not just in the urban areas, but also in the rural communities and even some of our native populations?
Yeah, I think the key is a term that I like to use called functional unification. And what I mean by that term is we have a lot of diverse, separate organizations at the youth, adult, professional, athlete level. The beauty of US soccer is we combine those under one umbrella. Our challenge in the past is we have all worked in different silos. And so my problem wasn't necessarily MLS's problem or US club's problem or the adults' problem or vice versa. At least that's what I thought because I was in my silo. As we've become and established more collaborative relationships over the last couple years, and I give a lot of credit to some of my fellow board members at US Soccer, Michael Caron, Mike Kalina, Don Garber, Chris Ahrens, et cetera. We've learned to first communicate with each other, and we've now learned that there's a lot more commonality than differences with us. And an example of that might be MLS has started MLS Go. And when that was first proposed, I can be honest that a lot of my state associations and a lot of the youth organizations felt threatened by that. They thought, well, what is MLS doing going into the youth market below the competitive level? You know, we could understand the MLS academies, you know, they're building players for the pros, but going into the urban and rural areas to try and serve underserved players and to get them to sign up and play. But wait a second, that's our job. But realistically, we were struggling, the youth organization struggling to reach those communities. And MLS, with its branding and with its outreach, was able to propose MLS Go to reach and target just those specific underserved individuals and giving those kids an opportunity to play. Once we had an opportunity to talk, and I'm talking about US soccer, I mean, US youth soccer and MLS, once we had an opportunity to communicate and collaborate on that, all of a sudden it became not a competition, but it became a collaboration to try and reach those kids. And think of different ways that we could support those, either with fundraising, scholarships, grants, et cetera. So now what has become an initial perceived competition has now become a collaboration and a partnership between us. And I think those kind of relationships are happening now, and I anticipate they're going to continue to happen in the future, especially with the current individuals that are the collaborative leaders of US Soccer.
And related to that, there's two things when I look at how this, all works and how we bring more people in. And one of those is that there is a language barrier that exists for a lot of people, not just the players who we're not reaching. And again, some of these communities where English may not be the first language or may not be spoken in the home, but also for players who are at a younger age are starting to consider Europe as a destination to begin their professional career. What has been done, or what's U.S. Soccer's role in your mind to kind of reduce those barriers from a language perspective and not only reach those players in these communities that, again, may not speak English inside the home, but also for players who are trying to prepare for their career that may take them abroad to a country that doesn't speak English? How does that work to help reduce those barriers for, not just the kids here, but also the kids who are preparing to go abroad?
Sure. I know that there's no specific organized program to teach multiple languages to players based on when they're where they may go play or where they may travel to. But I think here in America, we have to recognize that our second language is really Spanish, and really to reach out to the Latino groups that are out there, because a lot of the Latino groups are unaffiliated. And actually, being from Northern California, I was a goalkeeper, but I did most of my playing and most of my training in the North Bay Latin League. I was the only Caucasian on my team. The good thing was is soccer is a universal language, so I was very well accepted. I felt part of the team, et cetera. But I wish I would have known Spanish. That would have made it easier for me. I think for us, I think concentrating on Spanish and making sure that the communications and information that we provide to Americans at least is bilingual, including Spanish and English, I think is a good start. I think identifying certain regions where certain ethnicities and cultures are predominant, and then adding those second or third languages, again, to the information that's provided by either U.S. Soccer, state associations, or the various organizations would be helpful. A good example is the demographic of the Asian community embraces soccer in Asia, but we don't see the Asian community necessarily embrace soccer here in America. And we really don't have information that's given in Japanese or Chinese or even Filipino to the various communities where they may be concentrated. And I know if we look around America, we have different subsets in different areas that, that might be an attempt not only by the local groups, but maybe U.S. Soccer can support that development in various subsets of the country. So
we will return with more from Dr. Pete Sophie after this.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey everyone, are you looking for the latest gear for your U.S. national teams, Major League Soccer, the NWSL, or any other team in the world of soccer? The USA SoccerCast has affiliate partnerships that are ready to help you out. Head to linktree.com/USA SoccerCast, where we have links to Homage, Fanatics, the MLS Store, and Breaking Tee. You can get the jersey, shirt, hat, or accessory you're looking for to support your team, while also saving some money and helping this show in the process. Again, linktree.com/USA SoccerCast. Click on the links and get your gear. And we thank you as always for your support of the show. We're back, and we resume our interview with U.S. Soccer Vice Presidential Candidate Dr. Pete Sophie. I want to go back to overall governance here and looking at the role of vice president. One of the duties, according to the bylaws, is to identify new challenges in the soccer ecosystem and propose potential solutions and pathways. So I ask you, what in your mind is the new challenge facing this federation? And as vice president, what is your pathway to solving it?
Absolutely. Well, the primary challenge, and we've kind of touched on it throughout the interview so far, the primary challenge is going to be the functional unification of all of our membership. And what that's going to take is that's going to take collaboration, because we're going to get a bump in membership just because we're having Copa America and the World Cup and the Olympics and hopefully the Women's World Cup here. The key isn't getting that bump. It's what are we going to do with those players? Are we going to have referees to deal with that? Are we going to have coaches to deal with that? Are we going to have the right administrators collaborating together to deal with that? Or are we going to be back in the same old situation where we're competing to steal players from each other? I'm optimistic that we're going to do the former, not the latter. I think we're going to have our membership collaborating. I think we are going to have a functional unification of U.S. soccer over the next couple of years. And part of my optimism is based on the fact U.S. soccer has already started that. Several months ago, we had initial discussions about functional unification in America with the youth and with the adults. That's now been expanded to include all of the membership. And we actually have a dedicated group of U.S. soccer staff that are in the process of phase one of what they call the soccer ecosystem review. And what they're doing is they're reaching out to key stakeholders and membership. They've collected a lot of information. They were at the United Soccer Coaches in Anaheim a couple of weeks ago. They were at the ECNL symposium in Las Vegas a week ago. And they met with a number of stakeholders, a number of members at different levels of soccer, and they've collected that information. The reason I'm privy to that is as chairman of the Nomination and Governance Committee, the Nomination and Governance Committee is overseeing this initiative. And so we actually had a meeting yesterday morning to talk about that. And the three points that they actually raised, and I'll share those with you, from their information gathering was collaboration, connectivity, and approach. And essentially what they're going to do, I asked them for a tentative timeline, is they hope to have specifics available for the AGM in Dallas. They may even schedule a couple workshops to share with the membership the input they've got and what next steps are. And the hope is that we're going to form a soccer ecosystem working group in about 3 weeks, and that working group will become functional at that point and begin working towards strategies with the various stakeholders and then develop a plan that we can implement, with the goal being we want to implement it by the end of this year, the first part of next year, so that we're ready for all of those large events that are coming in. So that's where my optimism is based, is I think we have some really highly qualified staff that are working on this. I know we've got some committed, dedicated, collaborative leaders, including myself, that are spearheading this. And so I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to achieve that functional unification we talked about.
We're going to talk about Copa America and the World Cup in just a minute, but I did want to go to the professional leagues that we have here. And of course, I don't know if you're on Twitter a lot or on social media, but of course the big debate is whether promotion relegation would be the go-to system that would help soccer thrive here in the United States, as it does in other systems across the world. Between MLS, USL, USL League One, and also on the women's side, you have the NWSL and the USL Super League and W League. What is your opinion? Are you in favor of a promotion relegation system, or is there another system that you think would work to help benefit the rise of all of these leagues?
Excuse me. I think to be honest, I think the professional leaders in our organization probably have a much better perspective on that. From a fan's perspective, which that's what the pros are about, is having fans like us that watch those games, go to those games, etc. I think promotion relegation, when you see it over in Europe, it's exciting to see people move up and down, up and down. So there is merit to that. But with that being said, in American sports, you don't really see that. I don't see that if the 49ers lose the game last weekend that they're moved to the second division.
That's they're a sore subject. I'm a Lions fan. This is a sore subject for me. So, yeah.
Well, I apologize. You should be very proud of those Lions because.
Yeah,
they,
absolutely. I know you're from the Bay really Area, well. So congratulations. But yeah, please go ahead.
I thought you had us. I would say that I would defer to the professionals on this question, but I think there's merit to both. I mean, there's a certain consistency and standardization of knowing that your team is always going to be, quote unquote, in the top division. I know I'm an Earthquake, San Jose Earthquakes fan, and we've actually won a couple of championships. But the last couple of years, we haven't necessarily done that well. And a couple of years ago, if there was relegation and promotion, we would have been relegated. So I'm not sure as a fan how I would have felt about that. Now, from a league perspective, you know, I'd have to defer to Commissioner Garber or Mr. Papadakis and how they would think that the professionals would react to the relegation and promotion, at least with the top level. So I guess my answer is I don't really have a clear answer.
And just related to that, and again, in your capacity that you know, I think the number one issue facing all these leagues and all these teams is stability. You know, we have leagues that are losing teams, gaining teams. As you mentioned, there's not promotion relegation, but we still have a lot of volatility between these different leagues. Teams are, you know, leaving one league for another and vice versa. How does U.S. soccer help these leagues maintain their stability? So if they do want to switch formats, they're able to.
Yeah, I think U.S. soccer is taking a more active role, an accountability role for the strength and stability of the professional leagues. And I'll use a local example. You look at Bay FC, they're coming into the NWSL, and they're supported by a lot of our former athletes. And one of the co-owners is Danielle Slayton, who's one of our board members. I see U.S. soccer actively supporting that women's team being reestablished here in the Bay Area, which we have great soccer fans here. We've always turned out in numbers and support here, but we've always had teams taken away from us or we've lost teams. The Cyber Rays were a good example. They won the championship, and then the next year they were gone. So, you know, you buy your Cyber Ray jersey and it's now in my closet because there's no more Cyber Rays. So I think there, like you said, the stability is important in the professional leagues. I think I see a different approach now from U.S. soccer than maybe in the past, especially on the women's side. And not only with the abuse topics that we discussed earlier, but actually the financial support and getting the field support and really helping build that game. And I also see, for that matter, I see the men's professional leagues supporting the women's professional leagues in being reestablished and growing. And, you know, this is an unprecedented era for growth of professional soccer, both male, female, at all levels in the United States. And I think I see U.S. soccer taking a more active role in that.
I want to shift, you know, a little bit more globally. Obviously, the world is coming to the United States in the next few years for several different tournaments, Copa America, W Gold Cup, you know, the Club World Cup next year, and then 2026 World Cup, and potentially, as you mentioned, the 2027 Women's World Cup, followed by the Olympics. A huge era is about to embark on us in U.S. soccer. But of course, we're trying to make this sport the preeminent sport in the country, and a preeminent team being the United States national teams. How do you continue to do that? And how do you open up more opportunities for Americans to see these teams play?
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is unprecedented. And I think a lot of it is based on the financial and commercial opportunities that FIFA and the rest of the world see in the United States. And I mean, yeah, granted, it's great that they gave us the Men's World Cup for, you know, this upcoming session. And it's great that Copa America is coming up here. But a lot of that's based on what we've done in the past with events and how successful they have been at the gate and commercially and through the media. And so I think FIFA and the rest of the world recognizes that we're kind of a gold mine here, and soccer is growing among the fans and among the players. And so I think that's going to continue. We're going to continue to have those opportunities as long as we continue to be good hosts and it continues to be successful here on a financial and commercial basis. And I don't see any reason it wouldn't. In fact, if anything, I think it's going to be very difficult to not have most of the major events occur in the United States in the future, just simply because we're going to be a hotbed, not of only fandom, but also of you know, TV rights, commercial rights. People, you know, like to come to the United States. It's a stable environment. So, yeah, I think from that perspective, I think we're going to continue to do well.
So, just as a follow-up to that, when we talk about the World Cup, for example, coming to our shores, usually the World Cup has a set of tickets, as you know, for the local fans that are way cheaper than the tickets that are shown to us as international fans that travel for these games. I've been to several World Cups on the men's and women's side. But, of course, a lot of people are almost, you know, anticipating that this World Cup would be the most expensive of all time and would price a lot of people out. How do you make it where, I know this is not a U.S. soccer-led or controlled event, but how do you advocate for that family in Oakland, or for me, the family here in D.C., who, you know, this is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see their national team play at a World Cup or any national team play at a World Cup? How do you make it where it doesn't cost them all their gold to get to those games?
It's going to be extremely difficult. It's not that it can't be done. An example you look at, I just saw the prices for the Super Bowl. The cheapest ticket is $10,000. Well, that I don't know any families, including myself, that are willing to spend $10,000 even for my 49ers. So I think it's going to be limited opportunities, unfortunately, for people. And I think we can increase those opportunities by the organizations themselves, both local, state, and national, purchasing tickets and making them affordable for families. And granted, we won't be able to purchase enough tickets to supply them to everybody that would like to go to these games. But at least if we made some efforts so that some of the people that can't afford these games, and you're right, we're going to price ourselves out. But if we can at least make it affordable for some families, I think that would be a worthwhile effort to do. And I think that would start with everybody. I would say local leagues having, you know, purchasing a block of tickets, or, you know, a national organization purchasing a block of tickets and maybe distributing them through a raffle or some other means. But, you know, it would be, I think, a very worthwhile cause for us to do that. I think it's a great question not a lot of people have considered. But I know after reading the paper this morning and looking at that Super Bowl cost, it makes all the sense in the world that a lot of these Copa and World Cup games, especially involving the United States, are going to be very, very difficult to financially afford.
When we look at, you know, just globally or even just regionally here, we have a question here from Eric Schmitz, and he writes and he says, soccer unites us here and with the world around us. Where do you see U.S. soccer's role and responsibility within CONCACAF? For obviously for our listeners, CONCACAF is the region we're in, North America, the Caribbean, and Central America. How do you envision U.S. soccer's role, or what has it been thus far, you know, given your status on the board, and how do you see that continue to evolve as CONCACAF continues to receive so much attention in the form of these tournaments?
Yeah, I think that our role is just going to continue to increase in importance. I think we already hold a central role. That's why we're holding these events. That's why we're always at the table when there's discussions about CONCACAF decisions, et cetera. You know, I think Cindy and JT have done an excellent job as leaders internationally for us, not only at CONCACAF, but also with FIFA. And I think that role and that importance is only going to increase. It can't do anything but that, because, again, America itself is increasing and CONCACAF as a area is increasing compared to other areas. It used to be there was Europe and then the rest of the world, and then there was Europe and then there was South America. But now I think CONCACAF is achieving a status that is nearing the same status as those two areas. Which is important, but you see that in Asia and Africa also. But I think in particular, CONCACAF, especially with the collaboration, again, between Mexico, ourselves, and Canada, not only for this World Cup, but between Mexico and us for the Women's World Cup bid, I think, again, is demonstrating the potential power and future power and influence of CONCACAF. So, yeah, the answer would be it's vital and big now. It's just going to get larger.
In the final question I have in this area, would it be something that U.S. soccer considers? Of course, there's not just the World Cups, the senior national team World Cups. There's also the youth national team World Cups. We're obviously getting the Club World Cup here as kind of a warm-up in 2025. Is it, you know, do you feel like it should be U.S. soccer's policy to try and get all these tournaments and land all these tournaments here in the United States, both on the men's and women's side?
Absolutely. But even more important, I think that we should do the same for the extended national teams. I think that we need to make a stronger effort to get the beach soccer championships here, get the power championships here, get the deaf soccer championship line. I mean, we have so many very successful, committed extended national teams that all have World Cups. And we have a number of our teams that are doing very well in those World Cups. Let them celebrate and win their championships on home soil. And I think, yeah, we should be actively pursuing, yes, the club championships and the, you know, the senior championships and the youth championships, but I also would extend that to the extended national teams. You know, let's get those championships here. I mean, one of the things that we've been working on at US soccer, US youth soccer, the last several months is we developed a relationship with beach soccer. And I'll be honest, prior to my conversations with those young ladies, I didn't know the size of the field or the construct of the field for beach soccer. I do now. I went to their presentation at the United Soccer Coaches Convention that we had sponsored in our U.S. youth soccer workshops. And it was fantastic. It was well attended. The three young ladies that presented did a fantastic job. They talked about their successes, talked about their travels. And we actually have pilot programs that we're starting with the beach soccer program with Northern California and North Texas and Virginia. And we have a half dozen other states that want to do the same thing, not necessarily on the coast. I have Indiana wants to explore developing a beach soccer program in their state. And I think the more we can support those extended national teams, both in education, promotion, and exposure, the more they're going to get athletes recruited to their sport. and we're going to become even stronger moving forward. And obviously, I would think if we could host the Beach Soccer World Cup here in America, what a great promotion that would be for the sport here. That not only is great for beach soccer, but a lot of those skills translate to the grass field and can be used for our other players in other avenues. So, short answer, yes, I think we should continue to strive for as many of those championships as we can.
I'm glad you mentioned the extended national teams. That was actually going to be my next question. So I'll follow up your answer with this. In the absence of those, you know, international tournaments, I think the extended national teams have done a great job at highlighting themselves over the last year or so. They've really started to build a lot of awareness with those teams. I'm sure you'd be happy to note that, you know, for me, I've been at games where we're watching a senior national team play on the field, and on our phones, we're watching power soccer, we're watching beach soccer when they're competing in the tournament. But how do you continue to build upon that awareness, bring more resources to them? I know obviously the National Training Center will help with that, but my question is, how do you get more fans to their events? Because again, they don't operate at the same windows as the senior and youth national teams. So how do you get more fans out to those, you know, events to, again, provide that even extra bit of awareness in the form of people cheering on these great teams that so well deserve it?
Yeah, and I think that's the pilot program that I previously mentioned with the Beach Soccer and USYS and the state associations is a good example of how we do that. I think we take every single one of those extended national teams and those various subsets of soccer, and I think we educate the heck and promote the heck out of them in all 50 states. And of course, we have 54 states because we divide a couple in half. But I think we do that, and it's gonna make a difference. I mean, our next extended national team that we're targeting is deaf soccer, and had the privilege of inviting Tripp Neal and a couple other people to our last phone call with Beach Soccer so they could see what we were doing with them. And he's very excited, and his group's very excited about partnering. And what I would like to see, and I mentioned this at the United Soccer Coaches Convention presentation with Beach Soccer, I attended their presentation, and it was a young coach that asked the ladies, so you're talking about this program that you have with USU Soccer. Do we have to be a member of USU Soccer to be part of this? And so I took the opportunity to stand up at that time, identify myself to the audience, and I answered the gentleman's question by saying, well, no, we're developing this program. US Youth is developing this pilot program with Beach Soccer to involve everyone. So if you're with AYSO or US Club, you just reach out to us and we'll include you in this program. Because this is what we want to do, is promote this program across all membership. And then we would do the same thing with power soccer, the same thing with deaf soccer, blind, and on down. And I think it has to be an active, not a passive process. Because to be honest, I can't wait to attend my first beach soccer game in person. They've got me excited just by listening to them talk and looking at some of the pictures. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to expose and promote them to as many avenues as we can. And we have the communication means. This is the age of social media. So there is really no inability for a lot of America to get some sort of exposure to this. Almost everyone has a cell phone, and that's all you need sometimes to just get a connection.
I know we're running a little bit late, but I want to wrap up with a couple of questions. My first one for you is, outside of soccer, you've been practicing for many years as a trauma, general, and thoracic surgeon, which is not something you see every day from people involved in the governance of US soccer. So what qualities do you take from your professional career that have helped you navigate all of these different avenues that we have here at US Soccer?
Well, to be a trauma surgeon, general surgeon, a thoracic surgeon, the number one quality you take from that applies to soccer is that you don't do it alone. So when I walk into an operating room, I love to say the phrase is, I never walk in there alone. And one of the things we do before we start any operation is every single person has the opportunity to speak and define their roles and make a commitment to the patient before they're asleep that we're going to do the best job we can to have that be successful. I think if you take that same sort of philosophy, it applies equally to soccer and the organizations here. I think each one of us that's involved, whether we're paid or we're volunteers, I think if each one of us comes forward, identifies our roles, makes a commitment to each other that we're going to do the best we can for the game of soccer, and in particular, the people that are participating in soccer, I think you're going to be successful. And that's what I've tried to apply during my soccer career, both as a player and as a referee and as a coach and as an administrator. And it equally, of course, applies in my profession as a surgeon.
As we enter this era, you're about to, again, have the election at the annual general meeting next weekend. There's going to be a lot of people in that room. And as someone who was proud to serve as co-chair on the fan council for 4 years, there's only going to be two votes represented by fans in that room. As we move forward, how would you incorporate the views of fans and include them more in the governance of U.S. soccer, provided that they have, you know, they're the reason why a lot of this infrastructure is needed and why you travel all over the country and why you're speaking to so many people? How do fans become more involved in this process, and how, as vice president, will you help bridge that gap?
Absolutely. Well, again, it's I would rely on the fact that I also am a fan. So I've been to have had the privilege and opportunity to attend a lot of World Cups. We went to France. My wife and I went to Vancouver. We've been to Brazil with the men. We had the opportunity to be at Pasadena when Brandy decided to do her thing with her shirt, which she still hates when I remind her of that. So I think being a fan, in addition to being the vice president, would already give me a perspective of what fans need. And I know we talked a little bit earlier about the professional sports and the stability and promotion. And that's what a fan wants. A fan just wants the ability to cheer and be happy, also to be disappointed and can't wait till the next game. You know, we talked about the 49ers and the Lions. Well, guess what? Next year, those roles could be reversed, but you and I will still be ardent fans for our football teams. And I think both of us and a lot of people in America are fans for soccer. And it starts at the beginning. It really starts at the youth. So maybe now I'm kind of showing my stripes as far as all the youth and time that I've spent with the youth. But if we can give the youth and their parents and their families a positive experience from the beginning, they're going to be our fans, and they'll be our fans for life. Our goal needs to be, we need to create fans for life. And the way you do that, you create a positive experience either as a player, as a spectator, referee, coach, and then you continue to support that experience. And I think that's what U.S. soccer is doing and needs to continue to do. And I think the most important thing is to continue to rely on their membership to support that goal.
And the last question I have for you before we let you go, this is your final pitch, final elevator speech, what have you, 60 seconds or what have you, your final pitch to fans that are following this election, again, summarizing your candidacy for U.S. soccer vice president.
Sure. I think I can make it simple. Like I said, I respect the other gentlemen that are running. I expect, you know, I respect them. I would say that the key qualities that I think a vice president needs in the upcoming 4 years is they need to have experience. They need to be collaborative leaders, and they need to be committed to this functional unification that I talked about, because that really is going to be the key to success during this four-year golden opportunity that we have coming up. Because if we drop the ball on this one, it's going to be difficult to recover. And again, I'm optimistic that we won't, but I do think it's going to take collaborative leadership. It's going to take experience. You don't learn the soccer culture and the soccer ecosystem in a few months. It takes years of communicating with people and working with goal-oriented perspective. So That would be my 2 cent pitch moving forward. And I just appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and share this information with anyone. And of course, anybody would like to reach out to me, they can feel free to grab me before Dallas. I think they're probably tired of hearing from Nathan and I by now, but I'm sure you'll hear a little bit more from both of us.
Dr. Pete Sophie, thank you so much for joining us on the USA SoccerCast. Really appreciate it. And I wish you the best of luck in the election. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Donald. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Once again, I'd like to thank Dr. Pete Sophie for coming on the show and answering these questions. Really appreciate him addressing fans via the show. And I'd also like to thank Nathan Goldberg and Mike Cullenove for coming on the show over the last week to discuss these important issues directly to fans. The election takes place next weekend at U.S. Soccer's annual general meeting in Dallas. The National Council meeting, where this election, among other things, takes place, will be on Saturday morning, February 10th, starting at 9 a.m. Streamed on U.S. Soccer's YouTube channel, so I highly encourage everyone to tune in and watch all of it. Get involved in the governance of our federation. It's only then that we can really see what it takes to make the improvements necessary to keep our soccer nation growing stronger, and we can make a push to get more fans involved in that process. And let me tell you, the National Council meeting is always interesting. There are a lot of fireworks that happens every single year, so I highly encourage you to check it out. The U.S. Soccer Fan Council has two votes for vice president among a sea of votes from the other member associations, athletes, and board members. So I know that they will represent us well. I just rolled off the Fan Council after serving 4 years, and they are really doing work to increase fan representation and make sure that we are all in that room next Saturday. But it helps if people sound off about the federation governance, tune in, and learn more about the issues facing our nation. So let us know who you think should be U.S. Soccer Vice President between Nathan Goldberg and Dr. Pete Sophie. Tag us on Twitter or sound off in the comments on the article for this episode over at starsandstripesfc.com. Speaking of YouTube, I'm excited to announce that we now have a YouTube channel where currently you can listen to every single episode of this show. So if YouTube is a way you listen to music and podcasts along with videos, you now have that option with this show. Head to youtube.com/@USASoccerCast. You can then subscribe and listen to the show there, like, rate, and review episodes one by one. It's highly appreciated. And hey, down the line, it may mean some video content for you. We don't have any video content yet, but you can at least listen to this show on that platform if you so choose. But that will do it for episode number 126 of the USA SoccerCast. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, follow us on Twitter. We are at USA SoccerCast. Don't forget, we have affiliate programs with Homage, Fanatics, MLS Store, and Breaking Tee. Head to linktree.com/USASoccerCast to learn more. Click the links to those sites and support the show while getting the latest gear. And of course, we encourage topic suggestions as we move forward. You can email them to usasoccercast@gmail.com or tag us on Twitter. We'll talk to you again soon, y'all. Peace.